Hello, everyone. It's a particular pleasure to introduce Cora Kaplan, who I've worked with on and off since the 1970s, memorably over a book called Fathers and Daughters, where she wrote the most wonderful piece, but it took me a great deal to get it out of her. Cora Kaplan is Honorary Professor of English at Queen Mary University of London and Professor Emeritus of English at Southampton University. In 2011-12, she was Senior Research Fellow at King's College, and from 1988-95, she held a chair in English at Rutgers University, where she was from 1992-95, the Director of the Institute for Research on Women. She's a patron of Chawton House Library, and a feminist cultural critic and theorist with a special interest in class and race. Her works focused on questions of aesthetic and politics in women's writing in Britain from late 18th century through the mid-Victorian period, and in fiction and film in the last 50 years. These issues were first brought together in Sea Change, a book called Sea Changes, Essays on Culture and Criticism, and later in Genders, co-authored with David Glover. Her most recent book, Victoriana, Histories, Fictions, and Criticism, continues this work. And she's got a special interest in neo-Victorian novels, film, and art practices, and particularly in memoir and its discontents. With Dr. Jenny Batchelor, she's the general editor of a formidable new 10-part series, The History of British Women's Writing. She has co-edited books on Harriet Martineau, Transatlantic Slavery, and James Baldwin. Her current project is a study of racial thinking and representation in 19th century Britain. She produced the most wonderful, groundbreaking critical anthology, Salt and Bitter and Good, Three Centuries of English and American Women Poets in 1975, at a time when people weren't doing such things. It's a very wonderful book. She edited and introduced the first modern edition in Britain of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's novel, quotes poem, Aurora Leigh, in 1978. Barrett Browning's anti-slavery poetry is a key focus in her current project on race and gender in Victorian Britain. So, welcome, Cora.
Well, needless to say, given my interests, I'm absolutely delighted to be here. Thank you so much, Ursula, for that lovely intro, and thank you all for being here. So I feel this is my first trip to Ledbury, and it seems to me it's been a long time coming, because I've been thinking about Elizabeth Barrett Browning since I sort of rediscovered her in the 1970s, and I've been writing about her on and off ever since. And of course, Aurora Leigh, some of you may know, reprises some of her early life nearby at Hope End. But I'm going to talk today about a different aspect of Barrett Browning's work, her anti-slavery poetry, and in particular this one poem, The Runaway Slave at Pilgrim's Point. And what I'm going to do is I have some bits to a bit to read, and then with my eye on the clock, what I'd like to do is to talk you a little bit through some more of the poem, because it's a long poem, which is I've given you probably not enough for all of you, but some copies. And I've got it on the screen. I've got sections of it on the screen because I think it's important if we're looking at a particular poem that we all look at it together and have some thoughts. And I hope I'm going to leave some time for questions. Pippa tells me that there could be a little extra time, you know, because there's nothing else here till later. So if we run over a little bit and you have questions, I'm really happy to talk about it with you. In fact, that would be my pleasure today. So again, thank you for the organizers of Ledbury for having me here. It just seems magical to be here. And I went to some wonderful things yesterday. So we're talking about a local poet, really, even if it's a long time since she was local, but she did live here. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, she was born Elizabeth Barrett Moulton Barrett. It's a big mouthful. Her father took the extra Barrett on when he inherited some more estates. But she was born at Coxall Hall near Durham in 1806. But the 500 acres of Hope End, and I think that was it, what its name was before they bought it. And also, Hope End doesn't mean what you think it means. It means the end of a valley or a dell. It's not, and it's interesting because one commentator I read said, well, that was a dismal name for a place, as if it were Hope's End. Whereas I always thought it's rather upbeat. He bought those 500 acres and its existing buildings in 1809 when she was three. And she was the eldest of 12 children. One died when very young, but 11 survived to adult life. And he was married to Mary Graham Clark, who was 6 years his senior. There in Hope End, he converted the existing Georgian house into stables and built an opulent mansion of Turkish design. And I'm going to try to give you, to go down to some pictures. By the way, this is Elizabeth young and old. Look at this Pickersgill portrait. It used to be ascribed to a woman artist, but I think it is now generally thought to be by Pickersgill, who's a much better known 19th century artist. And she's 20 years old in that, though she looks a bit younger. And here she is in 1858, 3 years before she died, in a very set portrait. There's one of Browning as well, but I'm only giving you Elizabeth's by a quite well-known Italian artist, Giorgio Giani. I thought you'd like those to sort of see her beginning and end of life. So here's Edward Barrett Moulton Barrett, a kind of rather youthful picture of her father, and indeed he was very young when he married and purchased the estate. And here's Hope End by Philip Ballard. So you can see some of the, that's a contemporary sketch. And there's another one by Arabella Barrett, one of Elizabeth's sisters. We can go back and forth between that. So brass balustrades, mahogany doors inlaid with mother of pearl, finely carved fireplaces, which were eventually complemented by lavish landscaping, ponds, grottos, kiosks, an ice house, a hot house. And there Elizabeth and her siblings spent, by her own account, an idyllic childhood. And more than that, they were 26 when they left. Her very young father, barely 21 when she was born, enjoying his rapidly expanding family when they were children. He really liked being, you know, the paterfamilias of all those children. And Elizabeth, who precociously clever and bookish, had the run of her father's extensive library. She recalls somewhere first encountering David Hume, Tom Paine, and Mary Wollstonecraft there. So, you know, it was a library of a kind. It was an Enlightenment man's library, even though Edward Barrett had, left public school, didn't like Cambridge, and left. He had a really extensive and very interesting library. And her father praised and encouraged her early poetic efforts, helped to have them published. He was extraordinarily proud of her. There's only one shadow on this portrait of an Edenic childhood, and it's a long shadow. The Hope End estate was purchased, and Edward's Oriental fantasies were realized with money directly earned from slavery in the West Indies. Edward had inherited extensive plantations in Jamaica. He grew up on one of his grandfather's plantations, Cinnamon Hill, and I'm going to try to give you, okay, that's Hope End. This was the house that was built when Hope End was raised, the Victorian house that became a guest house. And I've not been out there. Now it's now a private house. This is Cinnamon Hill. It's a modern version. I don't know how much it resembles it. This was Edward Barrett of Cinnamon Hill, and that was Elizabeth's father's grandfather. The father was a kind of rogue. So he grew up at Cinnamon Hill. Edward grew up at Cinnamon Hill with the grandfather, and then his mother brought him to England for schooling, as so many colonial planters' children came to England, and then he stayed. And these are just some other, the Barrett Hall Great House and Barrett Hall Sugar Works, and these are more contemporary sketches. Will give you an idea of that. So he grew up in one of his grandfather's plantations, Cinnamon Hill, and he also inherited, he inherited this and other businesses. And Mary Graham Clark's family's considerable wealth also came in great part from Jamaican slavery. So for both sides of Elizabeth's family, the money comes from the profits of slavery. This tainted inheritance was not unusual, as the legacies of British slave ownership project at University College London shows. And if you go on to that website, you can trace your own ancestors and everybody else's. You can do really elaborate things to look at the extent of British slave ownership, and particularly of the absentee landlords. Great houses across Britain were built on the profits of slavery, of the slave trade outlawed in 1807, of commerce, for example, trade in sugar, which of course was its leading cash crop, of the ships themselves that plied their business between Britain's colonies in Europe. Now, Edward, Elizabeth's father, based himself and his family in England. He was, in the parlance of the day, an absentee landlord. But after abolition, his brother Sam and later two of his sons went out to Jamaica to manage the estates. I think they both died there. Not the second son. One son, Sam, went to the bad and died there. And these estates were very profitable in the early decades of the century. They brought in, for an example, an estimated income of £4,000 in 1807, a year after Elizabeth's birth. And in 1830, Elizabeth had inherited the same sum of money from her grandmother on her mother's side, and after the death of her uncle Sam in Jamaica, a legacy from him, making her the most financially independent of Edward's children. This is why she was able, actually, to leave the house and go off with Browning. The other children were much more dependent on their father's money. And later in life, she and her husband, Robert Browning, were to receive an additional legacy from their friend and patron, John Kenyon, a poet and philanthropist, whose large fortune also came from slave plantations in Jamaica, where he was born. And Browning's family, too, had slave ownership connections, although his father had refused the financial legacy they brought. And yet, Elizabeth was a lifelong opponent of slavery, her hatred of the institution surfacing in two unpublished poems in her adolescence, one of them, The African, adapting a story she had been told by her cousin Richard, a West Indian Jamaican story in 1822. And what I wanted to read to you was this famous quotation that she wrote to her friend Anna Jameson in the early 1850s, urging her to read Uncle Tom's Cabin. "Is it possible," she asked, "that you think a woman has no business with questions like the question of slavery? She had better use a pen no more. She had better subside into slavery and concubinage herself. I think, as in times of old, shut herself up with the Penelopes in the women's apartment and take no rank among thinkers and speakers. Observe, I am an abolitionist, not to the fanatical degree because I hold that compensation should be given to the North by the North to the South as in England." And that final phrase is very important, as I'm going to tell you in a minute. But you can see how strong and how passionate her abolitionist anti-slavery sentiments were. Elizabeth Barrett Moulton Barrett's little kingdom starts to fall apart in 1831 as a result of the family's legal battles over inheritance, declining sugar prices, the effects of the 1831-32 slave rebellion in Jamaica, known as the Christmas Rebellion, and the expectation of abolition, which people generally felt was about to come. He's forced to sell Hope End, bringing an abrupt end to Elizabeth's idyllic childhood. In May 1833, a few months before Parliament abolished slavery, they abolished it in August, the vote was in August 1833, and it was implemented a year later. Elizabeth wrote to a friend, "Of course you know that the late bill has ruined the West Indians," meaning herself and other plantation owners, the West Indian interest. "The consternation here is very great. Nevertheless, I am glad and always shall be that the Negroes are virtually free." Yet her premonition of ruin was greatly exaggerated. The deal struck in Parliament included generous compensation to slave owners resident both in the West Indies and in Britain, £20 million, which I don't know what that would be in today's money, but a lot of money. Edward and Charles Moulton Barrett received, for example, for some of the estates, £7,734 for 397 enslaved men and women on their Oxford and Cambridge estates, those are the names of estates in Jamaica, and Edward a further share in £4,708 for 250 people on another plantation, Retreat Pen. Now, I'm giving you these figures to drive home the kind of reality of slavery, and it's the way in which the family's fortunes and their lives were steeped in it. The abolition of British slavery is itself only completed with the premature end of the so-called apprenticeship system in 1838, which didn't work out well, and they cut it short. Compensation was only the most immediate individual gain. The profits from slavery, already deeply embedded in Britain's economy, continued to enrich it in the wake of abolition. Moreover, the dominant discourse around it shifted. In succeeding decades, Britain, including former slave owners, preferred to think of itself as the nation that abolished slavery rather than one still heavily implicated in its troubling unequal legacies and also still profiting from the plantations and the colonies themselves. Its slaveholding past, from which it still profited, and we may say continues to profit if we follow the money through family and enterprise, as people have done, became very quickly a history that was disavowed in that paradoxical sense of the term, a reality known but not fully acknowledged. As Catherine Hall, the historian Catherine Hall, who's part of the UCL Slavery Project and has been writing about the Caribbean, Jamaica, and England for a very long time, suggests, after the end of apprenticeship in 1838 and through the mid-40s, the West Indies, together with the British slave past, was slipping out of public consciousness. However, debates about the sugar duties, fueled by anxieties about economic decline, brought it back into the foreground, with the freed Africans represented as indolent and lacking in discipline and ambition. I mean, what are we going to do with this free population? By the 1840s, even the West Indian planters were saying, well, we were all really for abolition. We were all really anti-slavery. But how to treat these new freed populations, how to regard them, that was a different question. Even though the new freed people who weren't working hard enough, weren't turning themselves into good docile peasants, were painted as the culprits, this image damaged the former owners. And Hall notes that the picture of the Caribbean as a place of failure and decline into barbarism was becoming widely accepted. So very complex attitudes toward slavery, their own history, toward the free people and former slaves, and the West Indies itself. And many writers in this period, again, are reprising certain aspects of slavery, some still defending its idyllic past and so forth. But Barrett Browning isn't one of them. And that's the story that we need to go on to tell here. Emancipation did not bring with it a more universally egalitarian attitude in Britain. Instead, racial thinking in the post-slavery period emphasized rather than dismissed racial difference, highlighting questions about the cultural, biological, and civic status of free men and women of African extraction. And although Barrett Browning hated slavery, she believed firmly in compensation, as you can see from that quote in the early 1850s. The American Southerners also ought to be compensated. And you don't, I mean, she never expands on this. I can't find a letter in which she talks, in a greater way. It was just assumed that slaveholders, they had property, they were going to lose it, they had to be compensated. You know, she didn't say, well, if they weren't, there would be civil disorder or it would extend, it just was understood. What is more, although her anti-slavery stance was lifelong, her adult anti-slavery poems were all published after 1846, that is, after she secretly married Robert Browning at the advanced age of 40 and immediately left her father's London house in Wimpole Street. She was, for the rest of her life, in self-exile from Britain, living first in France, where she met George Sand, amongst others, and then in Italy settled in Florence after that. In Italy, she was part of a kind of Anglo-American expatriate community, and lots of anti-slavery people. The sculptor Harriet Hosmer, she was part of a different kind of intellectual milieu. Edward Barrett Moulton Barrett was a most peculiar Victorian man, as I'm sure many of you know. For he forbade any of his children to marry and disinherited those few who dared to defy him. Elizabeth loved her father, and in trying to explain his autocratic rule of his household to Robert, referred in strikingly modern terms to his embrace of all those patriarchal ideas of governing grown-up children. He cut off all communication with his best-loved eldest child and her family. They never spoke again. The thumbnail sketch of the Barrett family background with the economic ground of its founding highlighted doesn't do justice to the way in which Elizabeth Barrett Browning became one of the major poets of her time. She's my very favorite 19th century poet, and that's saying a lot considering how many there were. A leading candidate for poet laureate, when Wordsworth died in 1850, even though she no longer lived in England, her popularity from the publication of her poems in 1844 extended to the end of the 19th century, when she seems to lose a natural audience for everything except her love sonnets to Browning, sonnets from the Portuguese. Do you all know that? Yes. Many of us grew up with at least some of those. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. It comes top of everybody's 10 favorite, 10 or 20 poems. She falls out of general critical favor, while Browning, younger and less celebrated for much of their marriage, survives as one of the major poetic figures, and justly so. I think Browning's a great poet. But second-wave feminism in the 1970s brings her back, and a major and much more favorable reassessment of her work begins from that moment. So now she is up there with her younger sister poets, Christina Rossetti and Emily Dickinson, both born in 1830, as the three great women poets of the 19th century. Dickinson greatly admired her and wrote a wonderful elegiac poem about her when she died. Now, just this year, Melvin Bragg, in Our Time on Radio 4, devoted a whole program to her semi-autobiographical novel poem, Aurora Leigh. Did any of you hear that? Well, if you don't, go into the archive. It's really, if you're interested in Barrett Browning, it's really a great program. And then a dramatized reading of it was also aired on the BBC, and that's also in the archive too, I think, over several days. So she's making a real full frontal comeback here. Now, it wasn't like everybody didn't like Barrett Browning. Virginia Woolf was a fan, and particularly of Aurora Leigh, and she told her readers and the common reader that they should read it as if it were a novel. Read it fast, don't read it for poetry, but you can pause on the poetry as well. I think it's well worth it. So we come now to the poem that you have in hand. As early as 1845, Maria Weston Chapman of the Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society, who with her sister had published an anti-slavery annual, which were modeled after the annual gift books of the time. They kind of contain all kinds of things filled with essays, fictions, poetry, images. And anti-slavery activists and sympathizers, including many literary figures, wrote for them. And she solicited a poem from Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who whose anti-slavery sentiments were well known. Now, in 1840, the World Anti-Slavery Convention was held in London, and I can't see that Maria Weston Chapman was part of the delegation. She had gone to Europe on other occasions. It had a big delegation of American women abolitionists, as well as Garrison and other leading American lights. And the big moment of that was that the British didn't think the women should be able to sit promiscuously in the audience with the men, so they were sent upstairs into a gallery. And Garrison was so outraged that he went up and sat with the women. And often this moment, Lucretia Martin and other American feminists, and often this moment is credited with the beginnings of the 19th century American feminism. In any case, because then they went off and sort of formed they decided women's rights were were just as important as anti-slavery. And by 1848 in Seneca Falls, they could create a document setting out what women ought to have. So gender was a very tense and difficult issue within women's movement, but that 1840 convention received a huge amount of publicity, and a lot of the people who came made connections with British anti-slavery activists who weren't at the convention itself. Harriet Martineau, who's the other major figure, one of the other major British anti-slavery activists, and writer, and thinker, met many of the American men and women during this period. But meanwhile, remember that these are the years that Elizabeth's in Wimpole Street, and not very well. So she's not. How she understands what happens at the conference is through other means. So anyway, Weston was associated with the most militant wing of American abolition, the Garrisonians, who wanted immediate abolition but forswore violence as a solution, counting on more peaceful tactics of persuasion, at least for the time being. And Elizabeth accepts the invitation and has the poem in mind by December 1845, but it's finished in Pisa in 1846 and published in December 1847 in the Liberty Bell Annual for 1848. They always publish the annual, in the month before the year it's actually dated. Writing to her friend Mary Russell Mitford, she voiced some of her anxieties about the poem's ferocious nature, worrying that it might be too ferocious for the Liberty Bell editors and their audience. I could not help making it bitter. The poem, indeed, is challenging and uncompromising. I'm just going to show you before I do that. So that's the cover of the Liberty Bell. You can see what the annual sort of looks like. And that's the inside image. But this is a sort of frontispiece. Truth shall make you free. And, so there's the figure of white liberty standing with all these sort of abject figures on the ground beneath. And she's holding possibly the Bible, maybe not the annual. And this is just an image of one page of a draft for the poem. So you can see her process and lots of crossings out and Xing and writing another verse in the margins. But the poem itself is very shocking. And teaching it over the years, I can testify to its power to shock. My students reading it or talking about it to different audiences, people really find it hard to take. And even those critics who greatly admire Elizabeth Barrett Browning have found it a difficult poem to read. And I think it is because it's provocative, and it's angry, and there's violence within it. It contains, you know, it contains a very shocking act. And what I want to do really in this, in time, is to kind of take you through the poem a little bit, because it's a long poem. I've got it on the screen. I've given it to you on a bit of paper, because I think I can say all I like about it, and I will. But you need to kind of feel that you're actually getting it, and it's too long for me to read it out and so forth. So I hope you'll come with me along this journey and say also what you think, because that's the interesting part. It's a tragic and melodramatic story which unfolds as a black female speaker, angry and eloquent, chased from the slave states and penned by her slave catchers at Pilgrim's Point, which is probably around Plymouth on the north shore of Massachusetts, where the landing place of the Mayflower is supposed to be and the origin of Plymouth Colony. Although the poem is absolutely set in America and all about America, people always, you know, what Elizabeth really knew about through stories and so forth was Jamaica. And so there's sort of always echoes of sort of Jamaican scenes and the mangoes, which make it feel as if there's a kind of, you know, cross-pollination of two sites, two geographies, both in mind. So I'm going to go down to the poem now. Okay, so this is where we start. But I'm going to reprise it for you first. She's chased from the slave states, penned at Pilgrim's Point, separated from the black slave she loves, raped by her owner, and it's implied in the poem. Raped by more than one person. And if those of you who have read Toni Morrison's Beloved, some of you will sort of recognize some of these elements in Beloved, and also the story of Margaret Garner, which is a later story than the poem's writing, a true story that Morrison partly based her novel on, about a runaway slave, Sethe, who kills one of her children. She gives birth to a son in the runaway slave, whose whiteness and his master's look drives her mad. Escaping with the dead child, she buries him and runs on, reminding the Americans in its opening stanza of the founding of the country through the exile of the white pilgrim ancestors. And here we go. Here's the poem. She's standing like so many anti-slavery poems. There's a huge, long tradition of anti-slavery poetry from Phyllis Wheatley in the 17th century, a black American slave, right up to Barrett Browning. Barrett Browning's not quite at the end, but almost at the end of that tradition. And one thing that I've tried to show in other kinds of talks and essays is the way in which she, a very literate person, sort of gathers together all these different themes and plays with them from earlier anti-slavery poetry, writes back, criticizes, extends them. For example, she makes the black woman slave speak in the King's English. She doesn't use some version of a kind of uneducated patois. She decides she's not going to do that. So she, you know, the black woman poet speaks through the black woman speaker speaks through the white woman poet altogether. And also this thing about being at the edge of the water. There are earlier anti-slavery poems where the poet is standing looking at her separation from Africa, from her children, from her home, from her lover. There's several poems like that in these poems written toward the end of the 18th century, and I won't go into them, but you can see them echoed here in small ways. And the other thing about that is Elizabeth Barrett Browning was she's a Victorian poet, but she's really a late romantic in lots of ways. So you get a lot of images of the romantic sublime, and I think I've called this poem somewhere else the black and white sublime, because there she is on the shore. She's looking outward, where exile turned to ancestor and God was thanked for liberty. So she's looking on, you know, she's calling on and looking at nature, and nature is both terrible and also awesome and so forth. She's run through the night. My skin is so dark. I bend my knee down on this mark. I look on the sky and the sea. But she's speaking directly to the ancestors of the American. And here she's got, as it were, the Americans by the short hairs, because the founding of America is founded on people running away for the sake of liberty. And here they are, the pilgrim souls. She conjures up their spirits, pale as dew, to witness her plight and name the slave catchers who in your names work sin and woe. And so the ancestors, they sort of troop around her. It's a very dramatic poem. You can see them sort of walking. O pilgrim souls, I gasped and run all night long from the whips of one who in your names work sin and woe. So it's an accusation. It starts with an accusation. And again, she's kneeling, but she's kneeling not before God exactly, but to feel the souls. And she's lifting her face not to pray, but to curse. So, you know, you're having these, right from the beginning, these shocking reversals. This isn't the figure of the kneeling slave in the anti-slavery emblems. Am I not a woman and a sister? You know, this is someone standing upright, not afraid to curse. So although there's a ventriloquation here, which for the modern ear thinks, you know, well, white woman, black slave, voicing the black slave, a bit problematic. What she's doing is making that slave contest every other image of what a woman's slave might be. The other thing I think that's happening in the poem is that it's an exercise in chiaroscuro, emphasizing and contrasting blackness and whiteness to the detriment of the latter. The Western association of whiteness with purity and virtues are reversed and become aligned with violence, injustice, inhumanity, and terror. And indeed, Herman Melville, who was a great fan of Elizabeth Barrett Browning in 1851, will write a poem in which the same reversal of images is using, a novel, Moby Dick, in which there's a chapter called The Whiteness of the Whale, which just summarizes everything that's terrifying about whiteness, the all color of no color, he calls it. And he's read this poem. there's lots of influences immediately that you might not point to that Barrett Browning has. And as in Blake's well-known poem, The Little Black Boy, from 1789, for I am black, but oh, my soul is white, the runaway slave speaker emphasizes her black face and black hand. She kneels not to pray, but to curse. Echoing Blake, I am black, I am black, she challenges God from making her black and casting his work away under the feet of his white creatures. And notice the emphasis on whiteness here. It's never an attractive emphasis. And then she's questioning, she goes on questioning God about his use of whiteness and blackness and his making, particularly of humans in different hierarchy. But the whiteness isn't valorized as in Blake's poem. Instead, the ethical coding of color is confronted as the speaker lists all the dark things that are made to be glad and merry as light, birds, streams, frogs, stars. And this theme continues through stanzas 6 and 7, from stanzas 6 and 8. And the line that I particularly like here is in stanza 7. Indeed, we live beneath his sky, that great smooth hand of God stretched out on all his children fatherly. And there's a wonderful extended way that line works. And then to bless them from the fear and doubt which would be if from this low place all opened straight up to his face into the grand eternity. So on the one hand, you have the blessing, and then immediately it shifts to where she's standing. And she said the only way in which that blessing would work for us is if we could all die at once and go up to heaven. So whereas in Blake's poems, you know, the little boy says, "I am black, but oh, my soul is white." Here, dark things are what is valorized. And the theme continues and emphasizes we are dark, we who are dark, we are dark, we're in the dark. Our souls are in care and cark, our blackness shuts like prison bars. Although they live like other humans and are feared equally by the beasts and birds who take us for very men. And I think that's a very important section where she says, "And the beasts and birds and wooden fold do fear and take us for very men. Even the animals know we're human. Could the whippoorwill or the cat of the glen look into my eyes and be bold?" So how you know they're of the same species as other humans is animals fear them. And I think that's important because one of the things it emphasizes is the antagonist is the way in this period in the late 1840s the idea that species of the idea of antagonism between races, antagonism between humans and others. The way you know that you're amongst your own is because others don't like you. Racial thinking and racial theory in this period, Robert Knox is a leading figure of the time, where you know he says that there can be no mixing of races. You know that races will be sterile in the end, and racially hybrid people are degenerates. So there's an exacerbation, I think, of racial difference that follows on from slavery, which seems counterintuitive, but that's actually sort of what's happening. And here it is. Here's the black woman speaker who says, "Hang on a minute, you know, we're human like other humans. Even if God doesn't recognize our humanness, you know, who are we?" and so forth. So it's a challenging poem for a period which has given up slavery, thinks of itself as anti-slavery, but has not kind of reached some kind of common sense egalitarian understanding of any kind. Then you have the passage, which is generally, you know, again, very like other earlier anti-slavery poetry. And she meets a lover. "I laughed in girlish glee, and one of my colors stood in the track where the drivers drove and looked at me, and tender and full was the look he gave. Can a slave look so at another slave? I look at the sky and the sea." And again, there's, you know, you shift from, it's as if nature can give her a kind of valorization, but also is a sight that sort of understands her despair, I think. And the fact that she has a lover, and this is again a theme in lots of earlier other women's anti-slavery poetry, "As free as if unsold, unbought, strong since we were two to conquer the world, we thought." And there are echoes of the sonnets from the Portuguese, you know, that sense of two people absolutely equal. And he, you know, there's allowed in the poem this romantic stanza, these few stanzas of romance and happiness. And then suddenly, we're black, we had no claim to love and bliss. They wrung my cold hands out of his. They dragged him where I crawled to touch his blood marks in the dust. Not much, ye pilgrim souls, though plain as this. And she's still, you know, she's still reminding you that she's speaking to these others, to this history, that it's not just an internal monologue, it's out towards someone. So, and then in stanzas 15 and 16, there's one stanza, "Wrong followed by a deeper wrong, mere grief too good for such as I. So the white men brought the shame ere long to strangle the sob of my agony. They would not leave me for my dull wet eyes. It was too merciful to let me weep pure tears and die." And again, the whole issue of her rape and her is as euphemistic as you can get in the 19th century. It's hardly mentioned. But the issue of it is, and that's what I'm going to talk about. That follows on, because in the following section we move from the rape, which is just sort of, you know, somehow off stage, can't be mentioned, you can't talk about it, and that's true of the 19th century novel when women are raped, particularly, you know, it's all presented very euphemistically. And Elizabeth Browning isn't a particularly euphemistic writer. In Aurora Leigh, she talks about spring's delicious trouble in the ground and sexuality. She's as forward as you can get for a woman writer, and particularly in the poem. But here the rape is somehow not talked about, but what is told in terrible detail is the infanticide. The reader spared nothing. The suffocation of the child and the mother's anguish is graphically described over five stanzas in which the higher powers show no mercy, no more mercy than white humans. And here you have them. She sees the baby, and the baby is too white. She doesn't kill the child to save it from slavery. She kills the child to save it from her own traumatized, phantasmatic notion that it represents, it's a male child, that it represents the master. Whereas the sort of salvationist kind of child murder is a theme throughout the 19th century, this is a very different kind of murder. So my own child, I could not bear to look in his face. It was too white. I covered him up with a handkerchief. I covered his face in close and tight, and he moaned and struggled, etc. He shivered from head to foot till after a time he lay instead too suddenly still and mute. I felt beside a stiffening cold. I dared to live up just a fold, as in lifting a tea, the mango fruit. And before that, you know, he struggles to get his master right. He beat with his head and his feet, his little feet that never grew. He struck them out as it was meat against my heart to break it through. I might have sung and made him mild, but I dared not sing to that white-faced child the only song I knew. And the child becomes kind of monstrous. Unlike the idea of the mixed-race child, the child becomes a kind of monstrous amalgamation in the poem for me, anyway. Terrifying. And we sort of, she tells it at such length and in such gruesome detail that you sort of, but you sort of go with her fear, or at least I do, up to a point. But it's still, I think it's a very troubling few stanzas. Okay, then she starts to sound a little bit mad. She keeps telling you further on that she isn't mad. You fine white angels who have seen nearest the secret of God's power and plucked my fruit to make them wine and sucked the soul of that child of mine as the hummingbird sucks the soul of the flower. They freed the white child spirit so. And she runs away and she carries the body with her. Even though it's a month old. And then she runs from the white man's house and the black man's hut. She carries the body on, and she bears it through the forest. And then finally she scoops a hole beneath the moon and she buries it. Again, the theme of whiteness with through the forest tops the angels far with a white sharp finger from every star did point and mock what was done. And like the pale dew souls of the of the pilgrims, the angels, the white angels are mocking her from afar. And then she says, all changed to black earth, nothing white, a dark child in the dark ensued. And then she can sing a lullaby to the child when it's dark. And there's something I find, I mean, this is the point in the poem where I sort of, reading it, teaching it, kind of break down, because although it's a sentimental verse and a sentimental story, it's so stark, it's so unnatural, and that's the irony. Here, all through the poem, is this kind of intended irony that she can't, she's asking us to think, I think, about whiteness and blackness, and if this, and rape. So there's two different levels here. Is the child of rape the thing, that makes it so violent? Is it because It's the master's look. You know, there's so many different objects, so many different facts in there, so many elements to the trauma she's suffering with the child that makes the child frightening, but also beloved. It's still the child of her body. I find that there's even more grief and more complicated and paradoxical things to say than the poem can bear at this stage. And indeed, it has to move away from that, and it moves away to its resolution. Surrounded by her staring pursuers of the Washington race in what she ironically calls Free America, she testifies to her torment at their hands, curses them, and instructs her fellow victims to lift your hands, O slaves, and end where what I begun. So now, at the end, telling her story prompts her to become a kind of revolutionary, the forward guard of revolution, inciting the slaves to rebel. Comparing their sufferings to Christ, she argues that your white men are, after all, not gods indeed, nor able to make Christ again do good with bleeding. We who bleed are too heavy for our cross and fall and crush you and your seed. So instead of a resurrection, there'll be a rebellion. There'll be a violent rebellion. And yet this invoked violence, passive but deadly, is withdrawn in the last stanza. The fainting speaker is herself falling in her broken heart's disdain, in the name of the white child waiting for me in the deep black death where our kisses agree, she leaves the white men curse free. And it's interesting that that's the end of the poem. It's as if she lifts the curse. The poem has to have a kind of Christian, quasi-Christian resolution. It can end with the curse hanging in the air. But a few years later, she writes a poem in her own voice, the white poet's voice, and it's a curse for the nation. It's a curse from the depths of womanhood, is very salt and bitter and good. And that's, she directs also in America. And that's what I used for the title of my poetry collection, Salt and Bitter and Good. And the depths of womanhood, again, it's a shocking, it's a transgressive image, because it's not about tears, it's also about women's bleeding and so forth. It's as close as you can get to a transgressive feminist image in this period. So the poem, I'm going to stop because I do hope we can have just at least a few minutes of questions, but it seems to me the poem is still very troubling. Its depth, its rage comes out of the collision of the public and private history of the poet. I don't think a poet who wasn't so, I'm not sure a poet who wasn't so absolutely embedded and still guiltily profiting from slave money could have written a different kind of poem. Some critics want to say it's all about her father, but I think that's reducing the poem in ways. And I don't think it's also even psychologically absolutely right. She always mourned the fact that her family fortune, her legacy, her inheritance was the blood of the slave. And I think this poem is her way of getting it out there in ways that are both terrible, but also very moving, but also probably for modern readers also somewhat problematic. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions anyone might have. Yes.
That was obviously published in the magazine.
Yes.
Now, what was the reaction to it?
You know, this is what's so difficult when you try to find out what people think of this and that 19th century thing. They never talk about half the time they don't talk about the thing you want. The annual is full of, there's stories that are also kind of couched in melodrama. I mean, melodrama has got a bad name these days, but actually it can serve lots of, I think, interesting ends. And certainly in anti-slavery and political writing of the 19th century, it's a very effective medium. So whether they thought it was too ferocious or not, I don't know. She publishes it again in her collected poems. She changes it slightly. I'm not even sure which I finally photocopied here, whether the later or the earlier versions. And I, you know, that's another kind of thing where compare what she changes. And I don't think there, I haven't found a lot of commentary on it. Because I don't think those annuals got reviewed in the same way Aurora Leigh got reviewed everywhere in the mid-1850s. We know a lot about what reviewers and individual readers thought about that long poem, and even for 1844. But these annuals don't get reviewed. And when the poem is published, I think, in Poems of 1850, there are a lot of other things in that collection that people can draw from. So I don't have a lot of contemporary reaction to the poem. And I wish I did. I'm going to go digging more, because the magic of electronic research happens, the more things you can find out. And there might be stuff I never looked at actually about the poem. There's very interesting work done on it by Marjorie Stone, looking at the American context of the poem and the Garrisonians, and you know, other kinds of anti-slavery writing in the period, and you find that you can track that on the web, I think, and that's interesting. But that's a great question, and I really, really wish I knew.
Is there anything in her?
What? Sorry.
Is there anything in her correspondence?
I think she says, I was looking for that and I didn't quite find it, because I don't think it's in the, I think it's in correspondence I didn't quite have access to. But I think she does talk a little bit more about it in the correspondence. But more, no more than this, that it's a, but she doesn't talk about reception. She doesn't talk about the poems. No. I haven't found anything on the poem's reception in her own writing. But her fears for the poem and the fact that it's too strong, it's too bitter, it's too ferocious. So as I say, some critics have read those comments as, you know, as wanting to elide it. Angela Layton, also a poet, you know, seems to want to read it, I think, a little bit more through the tragic, you know, Edward Barrett and her rage against her father. It's a sort of displaced or very slightly displaced rage against the father. And sure, the family inheritance, which she bears on her back and spends every day, comes through really strongly. But I think that you miss its more general political and public meanings and the shocking way in which it tries to reverse color consciousness, color hierarchies, which, as I say, are ever, you know, being set in place even more strongly. Yes, and then, whichever.
Both.
Do you think this poem would be more accepted being the black person speaking through the white woman and talking about revolution?
Yeah.
If this had actually been written by a black person, would the white population not accepted it in a similar way at all?
I think that's absolutely right. Though, of course, by the mid-1840s, you have Frederick Douglass's autobiography, which is a great, great American ex-slave and marvelous writer, coming out and being read everywhere. There's a whole history of black writers writing enormously critically about slavery. Mary Prince, whose story is sort of mediated by a white writer who's one of the West Indian slaves, and her slave narrative is published in the early 1830s, just before emancipation. And she's pretty powerfully, she's pretty upfront and powerful about anti-slavery, you know, about what she thinks whites are responsible for. But it doesn't contain this kind of personal violence. And indeed, the anti-slavery societies were pretty keen to edit someone like Mary Prince, to edit her sexual history out of it. And that this poem, and you notice the sexual part, there's the romance part, that's sort of sentimental, and then there's like a brief paragraph would be in the thing, you know, a very short piece about what happens to her. It's the effects of what happens to her. So I think it would be, they didn't want black, the anti-slavery who mostly promoted and mediated black ex-slave writing at this period, I don't think they would have tolerated anything this, especially from a woman. You know, there's a whole tradition of angry, you know, angry, mad. You know, the 1847 is Jane Eyre and Bertha Mason, who is not black, but who becomes associated as she, you know, as the novel goes on with blackness and racial, and she's sort of subtly racialized. So the idea of female madness, black woman's madness, and so forth. And she keeps saying, I'm not mad, I'm black, you know. The trauma that she's saying is, you know, my madness is a kind of rationality. I'm telling it like it is here. But yes, I think you're absolutely right that you, she couldn't have written it. It couldn't be written in that way.
It's the important question. I wondered if that could be taken. What you thought about that, or whether you would take it, or whether it has been taken as a statement about the oppression of women, not just about women, but women generally.
Well, if so, I think it's very subliminal here, because in Aurora Leigh, you know, there's a lot of upfront sort of feminist verses. It's a kind of, you know, she can talk about that. And you can hear her in that letter, you know, about anti-slavery. Women have a right to speak about politics. She's a very political writer. She writes against the ragged schools. She's, you know, she's as much a political poet as she is any other kind of poet. So we can think about the feminism in this poem, and its complexity is that the kind of rage and anger gets displaced onto the black speaker. That's the other part of the poem. She kills the child. Would a white woman kill? You know, the infanticide is, and the rage is allowed to work itself out through the figure of the other, if you want to, you know, one or not, you know, rather than through. There's two violence here, two kinds of violence here. One, her violence to the child, which is sort of, you know, how does one take it at the end of the poem? You know, what do you take away from the poem about the woman's action in murdering the child? Is it forgiven? Is it she forgives? She rescinds her curse, but does the reader rescind theirs? You know, what sort of image do you have of a woman who, however angry and crazed, fantasizes that she sees the master in this baby and kills it? And I think by making that the act of the, however much she shows how the whips and curses of the white masters and their murderous tendencies are there, the one that's in our face is hers. So I think that the way violence happens and is displaced and orchestrated in the poem, I think is very disturbing, I think, if you see what I mean. Yes?
You referenced connection maybe to Toni Morrison.
Yeah.
That made me think of the song Strange Fruit.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
If there's any kind of lineage from this.
Not that I know of. I think Strange Fruit, I mean, because she says the fruit, my fruit hangs, but the strange fruit, of course, is the lynched figures in the thing, and maybe if fruit is not a word, you know, fruit of the womb is a sort of biblical phrase, and I don't know who first, you know, where that was first recorded, or how fruit was still used as, you know, being fruitful and so forth. Those of you watching The Handmaid's Tale, I think. Every Sunday, you know, the idea of fruitfulness and these, you know, biblical things they keep telling the... So I'm not sure, but it's an interesting connection. But if you want to read this real-life story of Margaret Garner, who kills her child rather than give it back to the slave catchers, you can, if you Google her up, you'll get full histories, and that's a very interesting story with a deeply ironic conclusion. What about the ironies of the poem? But people, do they come through for you? I mean, how did they work on the reader at the time? I'm just interested.
Huh? this isn't really talking about the irony exactly, but I was going back to what you said earlier about the free slaves and how people were worried that they were indolent and such like. And sort of, I wonder, to what extent do you think she had the single paragraph about the rape and then a lot of, as you said, violence that the black mother commits? Size. Is that her choice or what she thinks would be tolerated by her audience? To what extent does that reflect?
I don't think she, you know, I think it's really interesting. It's such a good question, and as all your questions would be. It's certainly an attack on the idea of passivity. And in that sense, it's a feminist, you know, it has its feminist implications that this woman is not a passive victim. She's not just a runaway. She's not a kneeling slave. But I think she was worried about the audience's tolerance of this, and had she gone too far? She talks about its bitterness, but it's not just its bitterness. It's actually she's created a scenario which she won't create again in any other poem. I mean, there's no other poem like it in her oeuvre. Even in Aurora Leigh, when the working class girl is raped and has an illegitimate child, she's allowed to keep that child. She's not allowed to marry, but she can keep the child. And the child grows up and is this beautiful little boy. Well, that's not true here. And one of the things, about this poem is in literature, these figures who commit the violence, they also have to die. You know, Bertha in the flames, and here, she doesn't get away to Canada. You know, she doesn't get away with her murder. She sort of die. You know, there's a fictional solution here. So will the audience tolerate it because in the end they know the slave catchers are somehow going to get her or she's, you know, she's near death, she's near recapture, but she's swooning, she's dying. So I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's very difficult to know.
Yeah.
What she was
And I wonder if she knows. The poem is very controlled, so I don't want to say she doesn't know herself. But every poem, once it's out in the world, has its own conscious and unconscious, and she does revise it. And Simon Armitage last night, was some of you at Simon Armitage last night when he said he has a poem which has a really rude reference, and he said, "You'll have to believe me when I wrote that. I didn't hear the double entendre until I actually read it to an audience." So I think there's a lot going on in the poem that may not even be, fully conscious. I don't want to say it, but only semi-conscious. You know, maybe there's forms of disavowal going on in the poem. I mean, in a sense, about what she's actually doing in it. I mean, she has a series of miscarriages in these years, and then she has a kid, magically in her early 40s in the 19th century. She has a son, Penn. So the dead baby by 1846, when she's writing the poem, is not, childbirth and pregnancy is not unknown to her now. She's not an isolated 39-year-old virgin living in Wimpole Street. So, and there is the whole trauma of her father, absolutely traumatic. Her father returned all the letters were on to that she wrote to him constantly were unopened, given back to Robert, I think after, after the father's death. And when he died in 57, she practically had a breakdown. She was devastated that there'd been no reconciliation. So, I mean, that's not quite an answer to the idea about the violence in the poem, but where the violence comes from and how it gets mapped in the poem, I think there's is both very deliberate, very crafted. I think she's an amazing poet. I think and I don't know whether it helps or not to have the family, the family history. But I don't want to reduce the poem to that history. But because I want to contextualize it, I want to think about it in terms of the family's immersion in slavery. So I'm caught between two stools, between wanting to read the poem as it is, but also to, to talk about and think about what it meant for a woman with her particular history to write such a poem. So, you know, part of me wants to ignore that and just read the poem. The other part of me wants to go deeper and deeper into the other end of it. And I don't know what other people feel as they read poems. Yes?
You mentioned irony a little earlier. It occurs there a little bit in verse 34 in the second line. For in this union,
yes,
and she capitalizes union, mentioned, is it in the Declaration of Independence?
Yes.
It's not a union at all.
No.
And then later on, when she capitalizes he,
yes,
is that a reference to the gender of God?
Yeah, you have set two kinds of men in adverse rows, each loathing each. And I guess that's the North and the South, but it's also as she's made the aversion between whites and blacks there, it's sort of compacted there. I've never been sure who the two rows are in 47, but I think it is still the slave states and the non-slave states, but it's also as she imagines them, the slaves and the white masters. And all forget the seven wounds in Christ's body fair, which he, God, sees gaping everywhere, are countless wounds that pay no debt. And that's very compressed, isn't it? She's trying to talk about the biblical wounds and their meaning for a Christian reader at one level. Our wounds are different. Can somebody who's more versed in religion parse that for me? Because I don't think I understand it. What do you think?
She's saying, is it really Christ's wounds that matter, paying for our sins? But what about our wounds?
That's right. Our wounds are different, and they're very material. They're very material. They can't. They can't be abstracted imaginatively to redress the sins of others. When Melville writes a poem in Battle Pieces, collected poems about the war, he talks about in one poem, the spire falls crashing into the town. And when I read this, I knew the Melville poem, and when I read this about we fall and crush you with our seed, I thought it's almost like that's sort of that he's the church. It's the redress of the conflict for him. You know, is a sort of destruction or a collapse, a violent collapse of everything. To do with democracy and the forms of Christianity, and he's quite ambivalent about the war. And I think that feels a little bit like that to me. We fall and crush you with our seed. Anybody else on that? I mean, I need help here. I've lived with it.
Yeah. Last question, yeah. Just because of setting up for the next.
Sure.
If that's all right. Do you by any chance see any reference to again the biblical Abraham and Isaac? And the sacrifice of the child, ordained by a greater power, the master in the Old Testament of God, and somehow that this is no longer a parallel, this is no longer possible.
Bill, maybe, yes, thank you. I suppose that's very possible. She doesn't expand the reference, but perhaps it's just contracted there and she assumes her readers will know it.
The lack of seed, the lack of generation.
Yeah.
No longer following.
Yes, crushing the seed of the white thing is to allow them not to reproduce anymore. Also, yes. Yes, I think that sounds very good to me. Well, thank you, Pippa's bringing me to a close.
I'm sure we could spend all day.
Well,
obviously lots of people have lots of wonderful ideas and questions. And I think we'd all like to say thank you very much to Cora for a fascinating talk.